Hi, John.
Hey, Alex.
Do you know what I hate?
What is it that you hate?
Well, back in 1992, I had met this lady, and we were at the Army base at the time. Well, I should go back. I joined the Army because I had met this other lady. This is about, I think, Dickety 1 at the time. Oh, man, she had the beautiful yellow dress, these deep marigold eyes, and we just fell in love with each other. And I met the next girl, and we fell in love with each other anyway. So we're poly-demi. This was a little... Oh, by the way, this is 2000 Dickety 2. And I don't know what Dickety means. You know, yada, yada, yada. Big fish. Let's talk it over, baby, before we start. I heard about the way you overdo your part.
At first, I thought you were a narcissistic blowhard, and then nothing changed, but I love you now.
This movie is problematic for me, because it pulls on every emotion I own, and it does it well. Like, I weep openly watching this movie, especially at the, you know, towards the end. But also, I kind of hate the characters in the movie. I don't hate.
Yes.
But, like, I think Billy Crudup is... It couldn't have been a worse choice for... Well, not... there could have been worse choices for his role, but, like, he's...
Yahoo, serious?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. When I was saying that, I meant legitimate possible casting choices. Of those legitimate possible casting choices, he may be of the worst. Like, he's fucking terrible. And I think he takes away a lot of what this movie could have been. And then... yeah, the Albert Finney part, which I think Albert Finney is delightful, and he's so good in this, but...
Always, yeah.
That kind of blowhard, you know, raconteur-style person is narcissistic, I guess. I mean, I don't know if narcissistic is the right word, but I agree with you, but I think it's a little more subtle than that, but, no use splitting that hair. But it's weird to have a guy that keeps telling the same joke over and over again that doesn't begin with a black guy, because that's my dad. see, it's weird because he's very much like my dad, except charismatic and doesn't have Italians or homos in his jokes. You know,
yeah. Yeah. Spend a lot of time going, oh,
yeah, yeah. Oh, what? Come on, it's funny. That's yeah. Albert Finney doesn't have to explain why it's not racist. He had a black friend back in Nam.
My car ended up in a tree. I'm just saying what we're all thinking.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. That Albert Finney is actually just a horrific alcoholic, and that's the entire movie.
I 100% understand and can sympathize with your predicament with this movie in terms of like wanting to cry and stuff like that. So there are a few moments where I kind of felt it a little bit as well. And I think if I had seen it when it had come out, I probably would have ended up tearing up in the theater.
Yeah.
No, thank you. I did not care for this movie. Like I get what it's doing. I think it's decently made. Overall, I'd say my issue is that the flights of fancy seem much more for the director than the audience. It's a chance for Tim Burton to do a whole bunch of stuff and have these kind of like neat visual things, which are neat, but like there's no deep human connection. And it feels at the end that it's like, yeah, nothing has really changed with Albert Finney. His son just went, yeah, well, you know, like that, like it sets up this big core fight between him and his dad, because you find out early on that, yeah, His dad tells these tall tales, and at the son's wedding, Billy Crudup's wedding, he yells at his dad about, like, stop telling the same stories all the time, and it's always about you. This is my special day, damn it. And then they don't talk for 3 years, and, oh, it's this big thing. And by the end, I don't feel like that relationship has changed other than that he's dying.
Yeah.
And so the big send-off at the end, and we can get there. I feel like it part of it didn't really work for me. I liked it, but it still didn't really work for me. But we can talk about the ending when we get there.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to circle around, but I think the main thing that I'm just going to disagree with you on is I think the it's accepting Albert Finney for who he is, except realizing that he wasn't lying, is the emotional arc that Billy Crudup's on. Because I mean,
yeah, but he sort of is. Like...
Yeah, no, but I mean, he's building. See, Billy Crudup thinks it's all bullshit,
right?
And then over the course of the movie, he realizes that it's like, no, this is just very elaborate retellings of something that actually happened. Like, he did actually buy a fucking town. You know, he did know circus performers. Which, by the way, that tall guy, there's no fucking way he was outliving Pimmick Albert Finney. That guy died 2 years after this movie was made, like in real life.
I texted you about this, that like this giant character that shows up later, like that actor just looks like the way he moves and stands. Maybe it's just that I'm getting older and hurt all the time, but like I just feel for him. I'm like, life just is pain for you.
I don't think it's you getting older. Painful. That guy died of, in quotes, natural causes at 32.
Oh my God.
So that's gigantism. Not the most biologically friendly condition to have, especially the kind of tall, gangly version.
Right. Yeah.
Because boy, you've got some knee pain there, and I think your heart kind of pops pretty early.
Yeah. Just whenever you would see him walk, it just, oh, poor fellow.
Yeah. But he was good in this. Nice. Yeah. He looked cool. I like his, I don't know if it's his an acting choice or that's just the way his body is, but I like the way he stands. I like the way he's kind of like hunches and a little bit to the left.
I think that's just his body.
I like it. It's a cool, it looks cool. Like he's got it's kind of like the
cool, but it looked cool.
Yeah, it's like that James Dean kind of thing where just like leaning on everything. I don't know. He just got this kind of like, he looks laid back as fuck. He's chill as fuck. He's chill AF. Sorry, I want to be hip with the kids of 10 years ago.
Sure. Well, I guess let's put this movie in a sort of context of Tim Burton. He kind of had a string of stinkers here.
Because this was right after Planet of the Apes, I think.
Yeah, this was right after Planet of the Apes, and like really. Planet of the Apes was really, I don't want to say it was his nadir, but it was like, it seemed like it was going to be. And then he went, oh, watch this. Hold my beer in this goblet, and I'm going to make some really, really terrible movies later.
Wait, what did he do worse than that?
Oh, we're going to find out.
I mean, I guess we are, but I've watched Planet of the Apes. I don't know that any of his other movies are worse than that one.
I the fact that I thought Mordecai was a Tim Burton movie, I think speaks for maybe how bad his movies have gotten. We'll see.
But he became kind of a self-parodist or whatever, but at least they were competently made kind of parody. Like, Planet of the Apes is, I don't know, it's something, abortion.
I can't make that argument yet, having not seen the newer ones, but just, I don't know, that nothing that I've seen of them leads me to believe they're any better than Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you're right. It's just, I have seen some of the newer ones. Oh, you know, well, we'll announce at the end of the episode. Yes, it's a good point now to tell people that sign up for Jaws Pod on Twitter. We vote on the next movie to watch, which you'll find out at the end of this episode what that's going to be.
Because I was thinking about how this seemed very different from some of Burton's other movies kind of visually. But then I remembered that he did Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which is also sort of bright and colorful and a lot less German expressionist.
Yeah, this feels very Pee-wee-like at times. Not as joyful, but very, kind of the visual language is kind of similar.
Well, and the particularly like, I think Tim Burton was a good choice for this. This was based on a book, but like was a good choice for these sort of flights of fancy. Because particularly at the beginning, I found this all very, very charming. And his story about like catching the giant fish or just... I forget what he calls his giganticism, but like how he's in bed for 3 years because his bones are outgrowing his body. Just Tim Burton's weird proto Wes Anderson-y kind of whimsy. I enjoyed in this movie.
Yeah, that scene was nice. The other choice for this, it was originally tied to Steven Spielberg, and he wanted Jack Nicholson to play both roles. It was going to be Jack Nicholson in the Albert Finney part, and then de-aged either digitally or with heavy makeup for the Ewan McGregor parts.
Huh.
Which I can't imagine in 2003 that would work at fucking all.
Yeah.
Because that's 2003 Jack Nicholson. That's not a spry, you know, maybe in Wolf era Jack Nicholson, you could sort of, you know, zhuzh him down a little bit to make him seem a little like properly young. But 2003, that's like jowly old man Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, I don't know. I really liked Albert Finney, though, but I generally do. I was a little worried because I didn't mind Billy Crudup. And I had said a couple episodes ago that Billy Crudup was my male counterpart to Mary Elizabeth Winstead in a character that, like, I think acting-wise, they're fine, but I don't like any movies that they're in. And I was starting to go like, oh, man, am I going to have to go back to my old – you know, just being sexist ways.
Yeah.
No. They pulled it off.
Well,
I did not like this movie that much.
I don't think Billy Crudup did he did a bad job. I just think he's the wrong actor for the job. I don't think his acting style worked, especially in the beginning. Towards the end, it was fine. Like, I bought him in the kind of reconciling part of it. But the beginning of him being like angry and weird, it just, I don't know. There was just something, there was a disconnect with the script and him and, or the, I don't know, maybe it's directing. I don't know what it is, but I just felt like there needed to be a different actor there. Cause especially just, yeah. he doesn't feel like, he's got this incredibly, incredibly loving, attractive wife. He lives in Paris. Like, it seems like he's got a pretty good life going for himself.
Yeah, like his only character trait is, I don't like my dad. Like that's kind of it.
Totally. But if you hired a charismatic actor, I think even though that is the whole character is, I don't like my dad. Mm-hmm. Having someone like I love Ewan McGregor in this, but Ewan McGregor in that role would bring that. Cause he's got that likability to him that even if he's just playing, I don't like my dad, there's that other life that he just kind of brings.
I guess I didn't need him to be that. Cause particularly because he's supposed to be this counterpart to his larger than life dad that, you know, they basically flew in an indie actor to do that because you have this, he's kind of this more sort of realist, naturalist kind of, performance, that I thought was a nice counterpart because not only just in the performances, but like the whole movie is Albert Finney, his character, because like, the soundtrack works over time to like, here's emotion and here's this, but it works with like his larger than life storytelling.
Yeah.
And so I think having like Billy Crudup feel out of place, I think makes some kind of sense because he is a fish out of water in Big Fish.
Yeah. So he's mad at his dad basically because he tells the same story over and over again. How do you become a stick in the mud? It just, I don't know. It doesn't work for me as a generational story.
It's because his dad, well, and here's, this gets into sort of the later issue, is because he just feels that his dad was only cared about his dad.
Yeah.
That it was all just about him, that he, you know, he wasn't really around much when he was a kid. When he was, he just told stories about how, you know, how great he was. And,
oh, come on. His dad jerked off to a mermaid fish and then fucked her a ring or something. I don't really remember what happened. But there was something to do with a ring. There was definitely a mermaid there. And that's how he got his mom. And that is love. And at the end, he gives the blue.
No one's denying
that. Yeah, he gives the blue trumpet back, I think.
But
is that a reference to that? Did that work at all?
I have no idea what the blue trumpet is.
There's a How I Met Your Mother. I think the end of it, that like something to do with like a blue.
I don't know.
I've literally never seen an episode. Somebody just explained to me what the show was and how the ending was. And it had something to do with very much like the Dark Tower series. At the end, he just shows back up with a fucking flute or something.
Oh, great. Now I'm just mad.
I don't even know how the movie starts. That's what I was trying to like talk about it in broad terms. Cause like it's such a vignette-y movie that like doing it in order is just a little awkward of, like all this great stuff happens and
Well, that's kind of goes into my issues with it is that, when it starts, it's, as you mentioned, there's this blow up with the family because it's between father and son, because the movie starts with the father telling this story about, this giant fish that no one could catch, but he caught using a wedding ring, and it's a metaphor, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, it's a metaphor. Oh, I didn't even pick up on that.
Yeah.
So his wife oh, God. I mean, now this whole movie is...
Son gets called back home because father is dying of cancer. Mom calls him, and their relationship is trying. They haven't talked for 3 years, but then mom calls and is like, your dad's dying, you should come home. And he and his French wife fly back, and they try to make amends. And again, this is a movie that, I said, again, like people had listened to the first part of this episode, this is a Patreon thing, but, the Stardust movie I actually liked a lot because you have these stories, you have him and his dad kind of connecting. I liked that a little bit. And a lot of it was Albert Finney just being charming as hell. But I think as you mentioned, Ewan McGregor does a good job with that, but his stories were very charming, but as they go on, they just wear on me. And I feel like you are put in the position as the audience are put in the position of the son where you're like, yeah, as the beginning, I really like these stories. And I'm like, man, these stories just kind of keep going, don't they? And, I feel like everyone has at least one friend that is full of shit all the time. That has just like, something has always happened to them. Like the craziest shit ever has always just happened to them. And you kind of, I mean, whether it's just a drunk at a bar or even if it's just, doesn't even have to be as highfalutin as I found a giant, but just some sort of stretching the truth. And you're like, yeah, that's okay. And that's sort of how I felt with this, where you just sort of tolerate it. And then it just, is this story going anywhere?
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from. I like the vignette style. The only part I was going to say, I wasn't huge into the early him seeing the witch and having the reflection in her eye, but them paying off that later, and it's hack, but I think it's deserved hack, where Helena Bonham Carter is like, well, I can be the witch and me in the story because in his world there's only two women, his wife and every other one.
Yeah.
I really like that. In a one, it's kind of cheesy, but two, it totally fits his character of this mythological creature that he thinks of himself as and his wife as the whatever Zeus's wife's name to his Zeus. What's Zeus's wife's name? Athena?
Hera.
Who's Athena?
Athena is Zeus's daughter. She sprang out of his skull.
Oh, Zeus's daughter. Okay. Yeah. All right. Close enough.
But yeah. And I did like that. Actually, I kind of liked the witch bit just because I liked all I thought the kids were cute. One of those is Miley Cyrus, by the way. The girl one is Miley Cyrus. Well, and then so because he sees her his death in her eyes, which is what the witch's power is supposed to be. You see how you're going to die. He's confident in everything he does because he's like, well, I know this isn't going to kill me because this isn't how I go. Which again, like at the beginning, I thought was super cute. And then it's just sort of like, man, this just gives him license to be an asshole.
Yeah, I did like his friend seeing that he's going to die jerking off to Playboy.
Yeah, I did like how they brought that back because that was when they first showed it at first, because you just see like one of his other friends looking into the eye and you see like an old man falling off a ladder and you're like, oh, okay, that's how that kid's going to die. But the other one, yeah, he's looking at a Playboy on the toilet and has a heart attack. And I'm surprised that they brought it back as like a legitimate thing in the movie, which really made me smile. But I feel bad for that actor. That played the grown-up version of that kid because he was in the TV show The Office as the guy who was first dating Pam and then Jim steals Pam away.
Oh,
from
that's
him.
Where I recognize from
yeah.
him from.
Yeah.
Yeah. he looks like
you know me as the guy who gets cucked.
Yeah, he looks like dumb Billy Zane.
That is a redundant term.
No, but like imagine Billy Zane, but like as like a big dummy. Like just like a big old dummy. That's what he looks like.
Yeah, I've not even seen the. I mean, Billy Zane has at least some suaveness to him. This guy just is a.
That's where the dumb comes from. I might be thinking. I'm probably not thinking of Billy Zane. I just said the wrong actor name.
Who's that guy from Zeebolus Jr.?
No, who's the bad guy from Titanic? Is who I'm thinking of. Is that Billy Zane?
That's Billy Zane.
Yeah. I don't know. That just he had like a Billy Zane look to him.
I'd put him more as like a PG Vincent D'Onofrio.
Okay.
Like, yeah, like a Sunday night Disney movie, Vincent D'Onofrio.
He's Vincent D'Onofrio in the Canadian made-for-TV version. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
In your face, Canada.
Yes, so, but yeah, then you just get all these stories about Bloom, the elder Bloom, Albert Finney's character, growing up and having these amazing things happen to him and like, finding a giant who's been eating all the livestock in the town.
What a delightful part in that, though, and I will never forgive you if you didn't like that, where he's like, what's her name? And he looks at it and goes, Carl.
Yes. No,
his name being Carl is, there's so many good, like, off-kilter jokes in this movie, and that is so perfect, this giant, that from myth, you're literally telling a myth about it, and his name's Carl.
One thing I was not expecting, but was super happy about, was the appearance of Robert Guillaume.
Oh, yeah.
It's a small role as the doctor, as Albert Finney's doctor, but man, I love that actor. I was thinking about how, like, I have not seen him in enough stuff, but he's great. So just shouting out to Robert Guillaume.
Yeah, I was going to say that, too. I love him. Yeah, he was Sports Night, which was an underrated show that was on. He was on.
It was a show he was on. I will agree with that much of it. I think it is justifiably underrated.
Oh, that was good.
I think when it came out, it was probably fine, but
well, that's when I watched it. Yeah, I'm not gonna claim. I have no idea what year that came out, but at the time, I quite liked it.
Yeah, I don't like Aaron Sorkin, so that's probably a lot of it. So that was his jam
because of all the words he uses.
Yeah, that's it. I don't like too many words.
Well, you're on record.
As a guy with a podcast, yeah. I hate when people talk.
Oh, come on. 90% of the words on this show is just both of us going, duh, hamina, hamina, hamina.
That's true, yes. Doing competing Jackie Gleason impressions. Yeah. No, it's just characters giving speeches at each other and whatever. That's a whole other episode.
I think I probably, that's my first Sorkin. It's the reason I liked it. Because I think your first Sorkin you're going to like until you get tired of
totally.
It.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's like the first time you see a Joss Whedon thing, you're like, oh my God, that was cool. But then you're like, oh, he just kind of does this, and now everyone's doing this.
I can't wait for a fight. Fantastic Four is coming out. It's Joss Whedon, baby. Loving it.
They're doing another Fantastic Four?
Yeah, they're supposed to. I mean, I don't know if it's officially announced, but apparently he's being courted to do it. And in the actual MCU, like, with all the other guys.
That's
well, I like right. it because I really like the idea of four very boring heroes from 60 years ago getting yeah. together and finally getting their chance to fail for the fifth time.
Did you ever read Planetary?
No. Well, maybe I did. That sounds familiar.
It's a fun comic series by Warren Ellis. There's more to it than this, but basically the villains behind everything are essentially the Fantastic Four. An alternate version of them that's four superpowered people. And it's great because it's like what the Fantastic Four does in their comics, but the reality of it and how they're like, oh no, we got all this amazing technology, but we are keeping it for ourselves because mankind can't handle it. We've decided. And so they use it instead to rule mankind.
Oh yeah. I always love those. Yeah. Like the ones where Superman becomes evil. Oh, yeah, I'm a sucker for a Red Sun kind of style story. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's great. Planetary. Check it out.
Speaking of Planetary, he walks to Spectre.
Yes.
Which
yeah.
I think this is a delightful sequence for a number of reasons, but one, big magical realism fan, and this is the perfect level of magical realism, where you find this town that's real-ish, mm-hmm. you know, it's, but everything's really off, but kind of, like, yeah. I like the idea of, it's almost Stepford Wives-y, where everything is perfect, and therefore really horrifying and disturbing.
See, but I don't think it's meant to be. I think it's just the only thing that's disturbing about it is that how good it is because he wants to go and seek his fortune. He can't just be happy here because everything about it is absolutely idyllic. I don't think there's anything nefarious behind it.
Well, not nefarious, but I mean off, you know, unsettling. Because I mean mm-hmm. it's clear where you show the dance sequence where he decides to leave. It's turning into one of those almost Pee-wee's Big Adventure scene with like the spinning faces laughing at him, you know, mm-hmm. it's turning into that. And then he goes, oh, I got to leave. And I like that of just the uncomfortability in this kind of, yeah, whatever you call it, Avalon type place. What's sure. that? Is Avalon, what's the city that keeps disappearing and reappearing?
Brigadoon?
Brigadoon, that's what I'm thinking of. I think Avalon does too, but Brigadoon's the one I was going with, yeah.
But I did like that sequence, and I did not know that Steve Buscemi was in this movie, so I was very excited to see him.
100% forgot he was in this, and yeah, I was so excited.
Always love Steve Buscemi. He is so great in this. He plays this poet that in the story that Albert Finney's character is telling, that he has already friended the giant from the previous story he told, and they're leaving the town together because they're both too big for this town. They're going to seek their fortune, and they find this path that. The only other person that took was a poet named like Norther something. And he's going to take that path to see where it goes. Cause only one guy has done it. So I'll meet the giant later. It goes down there and ends up at this town Spectre, which is this absolutely idyllic place. And I couldn't help but notice this is kind of a thing I'll get into later, but just the time that we're living in now, I couldn't help but notice like, ah, yes, how idyllic, no black people. But then I kind of much with the music as well. I went, well, yeah, but this is an old guy from the 50s, you know, that grew up in this time, and that would be his version of it. You know, not saying anything explicitly, he's explicitly racist, but his story wouldn't care about being woke or anything.
Yeah.
So I don't fault the movie for that.
Well, I mean, to be fair, it was the South, and the South is known for not having many people. Moving on. I didn't even think about that. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, but it's. But it's fine. I don't think it's fair to judge the movie for that. In the context of this, I think there's part of the larger message we'll get into. But or what I took from it. But this whole idyllic town is great, and he encounters the poet Norther, and his poems just kill me. It's such an easy joke, but there's a part like after he's settled in, like unplanned, he's settled in. A little girl steals his shoes. And he ends up sort of spending the night, at least the night there. He's standing with Steve Buscemi, like he's standing looking out this idyllic lake. And Steve Buscemi's sitting there writing, and he's like, "I've been working on this poem for 12 years." And it's like roses are red, violets are blue.
I think
this place is great.
The sky is blue, the grass is green. Spectre is so great.
Spectre is so great.
Yeah, like it's only three lines.
But the way just Buscemi sells it is great. How badly his pride is hurt.
Yeah.
In that moment.
Well, okay. So I don't want to go back to the race thing too much, but I just want to go back there for one second because it's just a thought. Who is a man? Okay. So he's telling the movie Big Fish is told from the perspective of Billy Crudup because he does the narration because he tells the story of the movie.
Okay.
So wouldn't the imaginary sequences be his imagination, not Albert Finney's? Because Albert Finney isn't telling,
because
he's not telling those stories. At the time of the movie, the stories are being told by Billy Crudup. Yeah, like he's remembering.
I think it's
or is this a conceit for the film? Yeah.
No, I think it's that everything that's not an Albert Finney story is narrated by Billy Crudup, but everything that's an Albert Finney story is Albert Finney.
Okay, so you know what I mean? It's like, kind of like time travel, like we're remembering when he told these stories.
Well, I think it's like the way you would read you might read a book where like this chapter is told from this character's point of view and this chapter is from this character's point of view. I think it's that kind of
thing. Yeah. No, I was just thinking because he's in bed, it's not like he's really doing the full raconteur bit. Cause it's like, oh, that would be creepy if that, yeah, it doesn't matter. I was just like, oh, cause if that's a 2003 person imagining an idyllic, you know, then that brings in some, cause I mean, he did move to France too, which is, So he runs away from Spectre because he doesn't want to settle down yet, which is fun. And there's a nice little, I bet you this book is very like Oprah Book Club because he's like, you know, sometimes your feet got to hurt. Sometimes pain has to happen for you to move forward. It's like a little t-shirt slogan-y, which I kind of like, but it's.
Well, yeah. In the same way that this is a story about telling stories, which feels a little bit like Neil Gaiman-y, like a story is a dream you make upon a wish kind of bullshit, but whatever.
Yeah. God, Neil Gaiman used to be really good in the 90s and the 80s. And then just,
I enjoy Sandman, and that's kind of as far as it goes.
I kept with him up to American Gods. And then after that, it's declining returns. What happens after he leaves Spectre? Is that where he goes to the circus?
So he leaves Spectre and he catches back up with the giant, end up taking a side trip to go to the circus. And again, I knew he was in this movie, but I had forgotten Danny DeVito. Super happy to see him, as always, playing a creep. He's the creepy ringmaster. And at the circus they're seeing, Danny DeVito comes out and is introducing the circus strongman and as you know, selling him. And he's this supposed to be this feral giant, and it's just you know some big tall bald guy. Ewan McGregor's like, you think that's a giant? Look at this piece of property I own. And the giant comes out. And well, that happens later. But when Danny DeVito is like, have you ever heard the term indentured servitude?
Oh, yeah. Wait, I have that written down because involuntary servitude and unconscionable contract.
Yeah,
I love that.
Great sign right here.
Yeah, and he signs on Deep Roy's back. And I'm sorry if that's not Deep Roy, but I think it is.
Which I started imagining, like, what is Tim Burton's relationship like with that guy?
Hot sex is my only guess.
Oh, okay. Right. My fault for asking.
Yes.
Go ahead.
No, you go. I was going to say something stupid.
This is the moment where Ewan McGregor sees the love of his life. And it's a neat moment when he's like, you know, they tell you that when you see the person you're destined to be with, the time stops. And it does. And he sees her like leaving the circus and time does stop. And he walks towards her, pushing away popcorn that's in the air and all this stuff.
Yeah, it's a beautiful shot. It's cheese balls. It's really good.
Yeah, it's a little cheesy, but like what I think really sells it is his follow-up, which is what they don't tell you is that when you come out of that, the time speeds up to catch up to where you are. And she disappears.
Yeah.
Because everything is in fast forward around him. And I thought that was like a cute gimmick. I enjoyed that a lot.
No, it's a nice joke. And the... that cut to him begging for a job and him going through the horrific jobs at the circus while getting pieces of just nonsense information about this girl once a month.
Yeah,
so basically he becomes a slave for 3 years and DeVito's like, ah, she likes music or something. All right. See you next month.
DeVito tells him like, if you work for me, you know, he's like, just tell me who that is. He's like, oh, I know who that is. He's like, tell me, well, you come work for me once a month. I'll tell you who this person is. And yeah, it's always something like, she likes daffodils. And the next month it'll be like, she likes music. Just the treacliest stuff. And it just doesn't matter.
But his wide-eyed...
that whole sequence is so much fun.
His wide-eyed just happiness of like slopping elephant shit and his head in a lion's mouth, just smiling.
Because he's like... a fat guy with a rag on a stick.
She likes college. Yeah. Oh, yeah. He watches a fat guy with a rag on a stick, which is delightful.
Yeah. And so this was... yeah. So at this point, I'm still on board. This is a lot of fun. And he eventually... finds out, well, he's going to go confront Danny DeVito that he's kind of had enough. And it turns out Danny DeVito's a werewolf.
Well, first of all, that trailer was clearly a rockin', and I do not know or agree with his a comin' a knockin'. All right.
Well, that law hadn't happened yet. That was more of that came out in the 60s.
Oh, yeah. After the Lupine Accords of 1964.
Yeah. This was a dark time in America. People were knocking all the time.
Yes. That's back when most of the economy was gas, grass, or ass. For no one could ride for free.
Ugh, scary.
Remember
times.
Those bumper stickers? Oh, boy.
People, I have several of
people
them.
People are gross.
Oh, my God. Danny DeVito is actually taller than Deep Roy. Just a little fact. Danny DeVito is 4'10". Deep Roy is 4'4".
Yeah. He's a powerful piece of man meat.
That's right.
Yeah, so Danny DeVito, werewolf, hilarious bit of why the fuck did this happen?
Yeah, so yeah, he because you think when he's going up the trail, you think, oh, they're banging in there. And yeah, no, it's a wolf comes out. Danny DeVito is fully wolfed. And my favorite part about that is Deep Roy, who I don't know if this is his first appearance in a Tim Burton movie, but he becomes like a staple in some of the later Tim Burton movies. He was in The Dark Crystal, that Deep Roy. What a guy. But he is a clown in the circus, and when Danny DeVito's character appears as the wolf, Deep Roy's clown, who's wearing this like these giant hoop pants, presses a button or something, and this latch leaks, and there's a gun and a bullet in like a velvet lining in the middle of his costume. And that killed me.
Yeah. It's
way more than it should have, but that was just the funniest thing.
It's, and his face sells it. He's so serious about like, shit's got to go down. Like he's been prepared for this moment.
You all laughed at me when I said this was going to happen.
Every full moon.
And of course, Bloom being, Bloom is able to win the day because he's like, oh no, he's not evil. He's just misunderstood and needs to play fetch. And so ends up sort of saving Danny DeVito from himself, or from being shot by Deep Roy. In the morning, Danny DeVito comes to his senses and is like, thank you. I'll tell you where the girl is. And I did like the joke where after Ewan McGregor leaves with this new information, Danny DeVito scratches his head with his foot.
Yes.
You just see a close-up of his head. He's like, and then this disgusting foot just covered in muck and mud from his night spent in the forest just starts scratching at his ear. And it just made me love Danny DeVito because he's just like, I'll do that. That's fine.
Yeah. What's terrible about that is that's an actor's foot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some other actor had to scratch Danny DeVito's head with his foot. Like every part of that is gross. Well done, Danny.
But I do like the idea, and I'm deciding this is true now. This is a rumor I'm starting on this podcast that much like Quentin Tarantino actually choking the actress in Inglourious Basterds, that is Tim Burton's foot. That is Tim Burton has always just wanted he's a foot guy. And
he's a selfish foot fetishist. Yeah.
So that like he likes stepping in things, like pies or something, and just mucky stuff, and then putting his feet on stuff.
I mean, so, he looks the
type. Go ahead and spread that online.
Yeah, I'm down. Yeah. He's into what's that thing where you step on stuff? What's that called?
I don't know. Crush videos.
Yeah, something like that.
But it's around here. Meets the girl. And then has to go through a whole lot of stuff to get her to fall in love with him. Something at this point, this movie has lost me.
Really? That's the part that did it? Because that's like the next scene after the werewolf.
Yeah. But it's like, we're getting into like 50 minutes to an hour into this movie. And like, I'm just so because his character is like, what's the stupid trope thing? A Mary Sue, you know, like his version of himself is that. And like, I'm like, yeah, okay. I get the idea that he in his own mind is this magical guy. Like I want to go back to the story of the father and son, but now I'm getting this more stuff about how amazing he is and all these like great fictitious things he's done. And I'm just kind of tired of it.
Yeah. I liked this part. Like I liked him winning her over with, you know, the kind of overly romantic stuff. Yeah.
It's still sweet, but that's why when I kind of went, I feel like this is just like Tim Burton's, like these are all just flights of fancy for him. I was talking about, but it's really when he goes to war that I officially check out. Although one of my favorite scenes is during that whole scene, but that whole trip. But
I'm kind of there with you, except it paid off enough that I kind of forgave it. But yeah, I think that's the one story too many is the going to war bit. But I like stuff in there so much that I'm kind of like, it's fine. I'll let it go.
Yeah, because he ends up winning her over, and then he's got to go to, you know, because her betrothed who has already made an ass of himself and she's left. When he finds her, she's supposed to get married, and it's the guy who was a jerk before when he was a kid. Blah, blah, blah. Guy dies on the toilet, like we talked about. And right as they're about to get hitched, he's got to go to war. My favorite, this just makes me so happy. And I could have watched this probably for another 20 minutes. He parachutes into North Korea and manages to parachute into a USO show, well, like a USO type show.
Well, to be fair, he parachutes into Asia because there's people speaking two different kinds of Chinese, a person speaking Korean. I think there's a Thai speaker. Like there's no, it's not an actual place. Sorry. It's just,
oh, I thought it was supposed to be the Korean War.
I guess like, it's what it's supposed to be, but none of there's four different Asiatic languages being spoken in the scene. It's another level of like, what the fuck is going on here?
But again, like that would totally make sense for the storytelling.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it's well, for the purposes of this, we're just going to say, we'll just say Asian, I guess, but it's an Asian guy on stage with doing a ventriloquist act to silence. And he's just telling a story. Like there's not even like that. He's telling jokes. It's all this monotone, whatever language it is. And then the puppet kind of goes, ha ha ha. At one point, I loved it.
Yeah.
It was so surreal and out and
getting dragged off stage.
So happy. Yeah.
They're getting
I could just watch that forever.
I was
for 20 minutes.
And I don't want to punch the movie up, but I believe what would be funnier is when the next act is coming out, you hear a gunshot followed by another gunshot, as in they executed the ventriloquist and then shot the dummy, but completely off screen. No, it's just two slow gunshot. I think that'd be very funny.
I do think that is funny, but I don't want anything bad to happen to that character. I'm imagining
he's your favorite
he was
now.
Taken away to perform for the Prince of Asia himself.
Yes. And then comes out the conjoined twins.
It irritated me. And this does not matter, but it still stuck in my craw a little bit. Everything before now has been in a separate language. Why are they singing in English?
Yeah, I got no answer for that.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. But like, it was just not, I don't know. And then when it's the science twins, it's like, oh, this, well, why not? Why not? I don't care. Like, I don't know. Because you get so used to these things being ridiculous that they're no longer ridiculous. He was able to save a werewolf, and oh, he parachuted right into this UFO. Oh yeah, why wouldn't there be Siamese twins there? Okay, and it's just like this onslaught of this stuff that I'm just kind of I don't care anymore.
Hmm. Yeah, I like it, but I can see where you're coming from. I'm won over by the whimsy of it still.
Yeah, I think I didn't had too much of it. I don't. There's nothing else here but the story, but him at this point. Of him just talking about how great he is and his far-fetched stories. And it's like, the point has been made. I've got it. Like, give me some more quote-unquote reality to have this play off against. But instead, I'm getting nothing but flights of fancy, and I don't like this guy anymore. He's just so full of him, you know.
Hmm.
He's such a Mary Sue or Marty Stew or whatever you want to call it. This shit's not cute anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree, but I see where you're coming from. Though we do get back to the real world around here where... there's the sequence where, he's supposed to be dead, blah, blah, blah. We can skip that. But back in the real world, the son is mowing the lawn or something, and there's a fish in the pond, like a big fish. And that was the one spot that annoyed me about this movie, because I like there to be a clear delineation between the fantastical world and the real world. I think this movie hinges on that. And
sure.
And Billy Crudup seeing that before he's kind of made his peace with his father, I think goes against the narrative that they're telling in the movie. It's small, but I think it's undeserved and too early.
At this point, you're getting a little bit more of the coming back to reality, but then you kind of go back more because to his stories, because then he has the whole story about how he became a traveling salesman, meets back up with Norther Winslow, the poet, who is now a bank robber. Which I liked, but I also just like Steve Buscemi, so that just helps sell it. And then manages to offhandedly convince Steve Buscemi to get into Wall Street financing, which allowed him to obtain his own dream house as Norther's way of saying thanks. That was a little bit more fun because it was ridiculous, but it wasn't as like fantastic. And I like that kind of tamping down of it a little bit at this point.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it. I also like the idea of robbing a bank that has no money because of like, you know, the SNL savings
and loan crisis.
Yeah. But it's just a funny beat.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and also I do love, and I, obviously, I mean, I don't know if it's in the book, but obviously this is the reference in the movie of the thing he's selling is, you know, Edward's Swiss Army knife hands.
Yes. Hilarious.
Which, by the way, I want one
back.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very bizarre, like that felt like a very like Tim Burton-y adventure. Like I said, like, I don't know if it's going to be, if it was in the book, but it certainly felt like Burton-y, that kind of weird whimsy, but also kind of creepy.
Yeah. I want one though. They seem awesome.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're cumbersome as hell, but I also like the idea of it would just keep your tools together a lot easier. You know, just like, oh, I'll put it back on the hand. Yeah. I thought that was rather cute.
Oh, John, I don't think you have any trouble putting your tool in your hand. Get it? Hey. Penis joke.
Oh, I thought you were talking about my carpentry.
Yeah. You're making that big wooden penis for the festival.
For the fertility festival that we have every summer.
Yes. I mean, we didn't
COVID be damned.
Yeah. We don't dance around the Maypole for nothing.
And we lock someone inside of it and set it on fire.
Yeah. I did like, so during that scene with the hand, is where he discovers the deed to the house in Spectre. And he's like, oh shit, this must be the lady that my dad was boning, because he's had a suspicion that his dad had another family.
Yes.
I do like that he puts it in the hand to hold it. It's a small moment of like, yeah, you know, maybe he doesn't hate his dad so much. His precious salesman thing is being used.
When he goes, so then Billy Crudup has this, Edward Bloom, the younger, goes to see, follow up with this will, thinking that perhaps this is the other family that he thinks maybe his dad had. Well, so he meets Helena Bonham Carter, who you've already seen as the witch, but as you mentioned later is no, she's this woman, Jenny, who still lived in Spectre.
Yeah. She was the little girl that stole his shoes in the early.
And so you start to get the truth or some version of the truth of what happened in Spectre. And it starts with him ending up there again, because his car gets, like, he drives into a flood, his car goes underwater. Yeah. The tie with like the nude mermaid thing I didn't catch. It's just an underwater naked person? Because you saw this thing earlier.
Yeah.
In one of his lives, and you see Tim Burton in this scene shows the mathematical correct amount of butt to convince you that a person is nude from the back. When he goes to approach her, Ewan McGregor goes to approach her, she dives away. Oh, that was weird. And then she appears later during this scene to save him. He's just like in his car at the bottom of some water looking at stuff. And then he wakes up and his car is in a tree and he's not in his car. And I just didn't catch what happened there.
Yeah, I'm not sure I knew what that was either. Because that's supposed to be the fish that can't be caught. It was explained by Jenny when he first saw the kind of siren thing.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe that's supposed to be representative of his wife, and that's why he doesn't, like, cheat on his wife, because, you know, because she's also the fish that, I don't know.
Sure, why
not? Yeah, it's weird. Yeah, so we go back to Jenny's house, and it revealed that she grew up and was waiting for him to come back home, and she married a man 10 years her senior as he was, and it didn't work out that well, and she kind of holds a grudge, which is not emotionally evolved of her. I mean, you had a childhood crush. It's, you know, weirdly enough, because he's in this, it's very Anakin Amidala of, yeah, you're fucking 10 years older. That's gross.
Yeah.
Like there's no way this should happen.
Yeah. That is weird, but, sure. Movie. Fine. Whatever. You're adults now. So that's fine. But so you find out that, yeah, they didn't, that Edward Bloom, that Albert Finney, Edward Bloom bought up the whole town because they finally got a road. And I did like this, where like a road showed up in the Spectre. Instead of everything being on grass, a road showed up, and then so did the banks. And everyone went into debt because they didn't know how money worked or something. Which I still like, I still don't understand why. I have a hard time like with my brain putting that together with this idyllic place that knew he was going to be there, but somehow don't understand how like, there are banks and people own money and somehow the real world showed up. Like I get that sort of that idyllic thing and the real world shows up and ruins it. But why did they know he was going to be there?
Well, I think that's just that kind of Jose. No. Who did 100 Years of Solitude? I think it's just kind of like a magical realism.
Jose
kind
Canseco.
Of thing. Yeah. Jose Canseco. He stole second base and then wrote 100 Years of Solitude. Yeah, I think it's just kind of a magical realism thing of, you know.
Gabriel Garcia.
Marquez. That's it. Yeah.
Marquez. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's just kind of like a magical realism sort of thing. Which 100 Years of Solitude is a story of, I just realized you probably haven't read that. That's not a burn on you reading books. It's just, it's not the most well-read book ever. But
no, I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's basically a story that lasts like 100 years of this town. And kind of the characters have the same names or sort of the same people. It's this weird repeated, like, it's just magical realism. It's very strange. It's a good book, but it's weird.
Ultimately just something that doesn't matter, but just, I thought it was going to pay off in some way, but it didn't. Like, it does. It's fine.
Well,
I think
it's kind of describing the kind of alternate destiny he could have had of, like, I think that it actually might be the explanation of the naked lady swimming, is that in another universe, he would have been with Jenny.
Ah, sure.
You know, because like he was supposed to be there, but he got there early. So if he'd showed up at the right time, he never would have gone to the circus, never would have met his wife. He would have ended up a Jenny and stayed inspector. And maybe that's sort of what we're referencing here, is the kind of alternate fate. Ariadne spinning her webs. There's webs in the way in. It's Ariadne. It's a whole Greek myth.
That's true. Oh, yeah. By the way, that whole...
I only said that because I forgot Zeus's wife's name and I wanted to show that I knew something about myths.
I'd forgotten the whole thing that when he takes the path, the spectre at the beginning, that there he walks through this like this cave, and there's a sign that's like danger jumping spiders.
Yeah.
I hated that so much.
Okay.
And it's not even that bad. I just hate spiders. And so when they're like jumping on him, and
I did like his line going into there, is the one thing I remember from Sunday school is that if something's hard, it's probably going to work out well or something like that. It's like this most idiotic view of the Bible ever. It's so great.
That's like my, some friends of mine had it was like a metal etching of Jesus. They found it at a Goodwill. And underneath it, it said, "I didn't say it'd be easy. I just said it'd be worth it." Man, that is my favorite. Now my favorite Jesus quote.
Oh yeah, I love that one. Yeah, that's from Wall Calendar 3-5.
Yeah, it was right after he gave his ass gas or grass speech on the mount.
Oh yes, that's the reason that Judas betrayed him, because you know he's a big ass fan.
I'm all out of ass. Billy Crudup finds out that, no, his dad didn't have an affair with this woman. He just bought up the entire town when he found out that it had gone into ruin, and then was bugging her to buy this house because he in order to buy the town, he had to own every piece of property. The trust that he set up needed to own every piece of property, and she was a holdout. And he helped her fix up the house, and she made advances, but he turned her down. And, yeah, so his dad's a good guy and loves his mom.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think it's because you're telling it in the kind of magical version of it, or the mythological version. I think you can read into it that this is the temptation point, you know, not to go full, you know, story circle Joseph Mythos thing, is
right.
This is him being tempted by something and saying no and going back. But you would assume that in the real life version of events was they probably made out a couple times while drunk and he like, just, you know, finally managed to not do it. But the fact is, he's hanging out with a really attractive lady. He doesn't, you know, it's
right.
There's more to the story, because it's one of those, you know, because we are hearing Big Fish tales. There's obviously other stuff going on. I'm not saying he's banging around, but I think that's the
that's
what's left on the table. Yeah,
and I do like this. I don't think it's explored that much. I mean, this is certainly one of the messages of the movies, but I feel like it's given a little short shrift with the idea, like, you don't really know your parents. You have this idea of them, but they're their own people. They've lived their own lives, and you only sort of know this version of them. So you're not necessarily, your view of their stuff is your view of them is colored by what you know of them. So him finding out these mind blowing truths about his dad. And I do like that element of it, but what bothers me is, so, Billy Crudup gets the call to basically like, oh, your dad's dying, and goes and is with Albert Finney in his last moments in the hospital, staying by his side. And Albert Finney's like, well, I know this isn't how I go yet. And basically has Billy Crudup narrate the end of his life.
Yeah. Which I can't tell you how much, like, fuck the rest of this movie. This is so good. This punched me in the heart repeatedly. Like, cause I don't have a good relationship with my father. I'll admit it. You know, so it's one of the, I know I make fun of him all the time on AlexCast. I forget how much I've told this audience about him, but I'm not going to, but the fact is I don't have that great. So like, this is just like, it's, oh, this is a reconciliation. No, I'm not going to have, like, this is like, this loved man, and oh man, and then him telling the story of his death, and it's like this wonderful chase scene, and all of his friends are there from the stories, and I love that Billy Crudup is making it up under the auspice of, well, all of these people are bullshit. You know, I know there's a few bits and pieces that are real because I met the one lady from the town, and you know he writes the whole thing, and his father dies. You know, he brings him to the river, turns into a fish, and it's like this beautiful, beautiful moment. And it's followed almost immediately by his real funeral. And the actual people from the story show up, like an aged Danny DeVito and the tall guy. And I am weeping because it's like, oh my God, they're here. And like the twins aren't conjoined, but they're there. And it's like all the bits and pieces of the story show up to his funeral. And it's, I'm getting emotional thinking about this. Oh, it's so good.
Yeah. Like I almost wish like the giant wasn't the giant though. You know what I mean? Like he was the big tall guy. Like he was the Colossus from the circus that the giant usurped in the tale. You know what I mean? Like it was a little too on the nose for me. Like even if it was just like a different short guy and not Danny DeVito, I probably would have enjoyed that a little bit better. But there's a certain amount of at this point where I feel like I said, made reference to in the beginning, is that nothing changed about Albert Finney. It was just Billy Crudup going, oh, turns out you're not completely full of shit. But that hasn't changed anything else about their argument. He still did nothing but talk about himself. He was not there for the majority of Billy Crudup's life.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed.
Well, but also we're only understanding his flaws through Billy Crudup. So when you say like, you know, when I talk about my dad, it's like, that's all he says is racist shit. Obviously not. That's probably 2% of what he says. Just that's what I remember because it's awful.
Yeah.
So, you know, even if this guy keeps telling the same stories over and over again, anytime a new person's in the room, he's waiting for a new person. You know, you can be annoyed that he wasn't in his life when he was a kid because he's a traveling salesman or whatever. But it seems like Albert Finney is well-liked and a charismatic person in the movie.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't think that was ever in question.
No, though. But what I mean is,
I feel like the central dramatic conceit never gets solved.
But I think the dramatic conceit is it's Billy Crudup I don't think Albert Finney has to, there's nothing for him to resolve. Is he lived a cool life and he liked telling stories about it. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with that. Is that Billy Crudup had a stick up his ass about it the whole time.
Yeah, and I guess that kind of sticks in my craw a little bit in the sense that rather than deal with the realities of stuff, it's just these highfalutin fancy stories that sugarcoat all reality. And then this movie is like, that's the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, I guess
I don't know that I love that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the movie's saying it exactly like that, but it's not saying that. It's
right. Yes. I don't think that's its intention.
Yeah.
But I do think it's saying it.
Yeah. See, I kind of like it because it's rare that you get a character that's not cynical. You know, Albert Finney in this isn't cynical. Like I can't think of times where it's, unless it's like a manic pixie dream girl or, you know, a dream grandma, as we discussed previously.
Yeah.
You don't get not cynical people. And Albert Finney is like this pure soul. Like, my life is great. I got to do great things. It was awesome. And then
so manic pixie Albert Finney.
Yeah. Manic pixie bathtub grandpa. But, you know, I don't know. I think that's kind of, I think the refreshingness of like having a positive character in something we watch really let me, and now that a character with a positive disposition let me kind of overlook some of the kind of one dimensional nature of his character, just because you don't get to see them that often. Or maybe just the movies I watch. Maybe there's probably a whole bunch of like Christian movies I would love because everybody's very nice to each other.
Yeah, I don't know. Because I got so tired of his storytelling and him being this perfect person throughout all of his stories. Like I just, the emotional weight of all this, like I could, it's a thing that like I recognize, but I don't understand it.
Yeah. I think what would have helped is, I don't know. There's no way to do it because he's on his deathbed the whole time. Or like, maybe if there's like a, who played the mother? I always forget that actress's name.
Jessica Lange.
Jessica Lange. I want to say Jessica Tandy, which I know that's not it, but it was like, those names conflate. If there was maybe a heart to heart with Jessica Lange, which is like, oh, your father knows, he just likes telling stories, you know, like some kind of.
Yeah. It's again, a case where I think like the book probably did it better. You know what I mean? Like, cause it could just spend more time with this and really dive into character and why I feel like the movie, it felt a little bit more like Tim Burton being like, I'm going to make this visually interesting thing and this visually interesting thing. And I feel like a lot of the actual emotional weight for this stuff didn't land for me because it didn't feel as weighted with anything. It felt like, cause I think that end bit, like I will admit, like it was effective, but I started to think about, like, I'm like, I actually, none of this really feels earned to a degree. I don't think, like I said, I don't feel like the central conceit of the drama has been addressed, other than going like, oh, he might not have been full of shit. Okay.
Yeah, but you know? There's also the other side of, you know, kind of, I think the conceit of it is a father and son, you know, not being on speaking terms because of the father's kind of storytelling. But the real thing is it's because of the son's inability to handle someone being like that. You know, there's nothing intrinsically wrong about it. And him kind of coming to terms with it and coming to terms with being a storyteller is not, you know, the worst thing in the universe. Like at the end where Billy credits with his kids and kind of letting them have flights of fancy and him saying, yep, that's about it. That guy was 15 feet tall. Sounds about right.
Yeah. But I mean, like, I think the storytelling covers up the thing that Albert Finney just only cared about himself and like his life and his stories.
Well, I think Albert, like, yeah. I mean, I don't think he only cared about himself though. I think
the idea with the specter is that no, he didn't. That he's actually this giving guy, but it's still.
Well, also most of his stories are based around his wife, you know, like his mythology is based around finding this amazing, this like amazing woman.
Right. That he's mythologized in his head that he won and he earned, like there. What do we know about the wife?
Oh no, totally. But what I mean is I'm not disagreeing with you. I think it could be spun. I think that you're spinning it towards a more kind of narcissistic personality. Valid, but I think the same evidence could be used to be a different, you know, go a different way, you know, that he's just someone that likes aggrandizing, you know, making mythology from his life. And part of that life is this wife that he loves and, you know,
mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's clear as that. I mean, that's one, I think, not failing of the film, but I would have liked to see that a little bit more, just a little bit more life to him as a person.
Right. Like, yeah. I would have liked to see a little bit more of the Albert Finney thing. Cause you do get that story when he tells Marion Cotard's character that, you know, like if you go into French Congo, all the parrots there just speak French and they don't talk about religion because you don't know who you're going to offend. That was a cute little moment.
Yeah.
And having a little bit more of that, of tall tales that didn't necessarily revolve around him, you know, maybe would have lended, helped that land a bit more. But to me still, I'm just like, yeah, this, and I'm not saying like, it's wrong that he's like that. Like I said, I just feel like when the central conceit is, I'm not talking to you because all you do is talk about yourself and it's all about you. I feel like that it was always still about him, even him saving, like even if he did this thing that was actually real and he bought and saved this whole town, it's still like presented this way of boy, isn't he great? But he didn't tell the story about how really he's great. He just made up all these things about how he was great. The guy's still great. I don't know. It didn't land with me.
Yeah. I see recovery. I guess, I don't know. I'm kind of fine with it. Maybe it's just because I have zero self-esteem. It's kind of nice to see someone actually like care about his life and, you know, remember it in a positive way.
It's a fine movie. It didn't land for me. I don't think you're wrong for liking it or anything like that. It was just my own emotional experience with it. It's not like a bad movie that I'm like, this is, like Dr. Sleep, where I'm like, what the fuck? This is, I just think is didn't do it for me, but is all right.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think it's a solid B+, but it smashed me emotionally. So like, mm-hmm. I'll keep coming, you know, I'll come back to it in the future. Just if I'm in the mood to cry a bit.
Sure. Sure.
Like it's got like a Wes Anderson, well, not necessarily all Wes Anderson, but it's got a, Royal Tenenbaums feel to it to me for like the emotion thing where it's just like, I don't know why this is destroying me, but it does. Like, it's just, it's pulling the exact right strings.
Yeah, but I guess I will say this is that although I didn't necessarily feel like that the ending was, like I said, like as emotionally as weighty as deserved, I didn't feel like it was manipulative. I didn't feel like it was trying to like cover up for any shortcomings. I feel, you know, like Billy Crudup, like telling the story to his dad and all that stuff, I thought was, I still liked that. I kind of just, I'm left a little cold, but it isn't a thing where with some of these other movies we've done where I'm like, I feel like you're trying to manipulate me into having emotions.
Yeah.
So I think maybe though you're talking about the sort of lack of cynicism is I think this movie absolutely is not cynical at all. And I do appreciate that.
Yeah, it's earnest in what it's doing. It's just, you know, sometimes maybe what it's doing doesn't exactly, you know, land well.
Yeah, I don't think there's any cynicism to what it's trying to do.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe Swiss Army Man.
Yeah, maybe I should just like get into, like, My Little Pony or something. Something nice. Maybe that's where I'm going with my life.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
Friendship is magic.
All right, so next week on the show, John, we have a very exciting thing to happen.
Oh, God, I am not looking forward to whatever this is.
Well, you know... We went to Twitter and the Facebook page, mm-hmm. and we asked the audience, what should we watch? And the choices were, as I pull them up, I don't remember, Dark Shadows, Alice in Wonderland,
sure,
or the Wonka remake that I don't remember the name. Now, we've got five votes.
Oh, boy.
We got seven votes.
Oh, now that makes me feel better.
Oh, it shouldn't. One for Dark Shadows. Three for Alice in Wonderland. And three for the Wonka remake.
Okay. How do we decide this?
John, we're going to have to do both movies for next episode. No, of course not. No. I don't know, because the only one I was leaning towards is Dark Shadows, because I've seen the other two. I haven't seen all of Alice in Wonderland, but I've seen Wonka. I don't know. I think I kind of have to leave this one up to you because I feel like you're the one that's going to get hurt more by one of these.
All right. So my choices are between Wonka and
Alice in Wonderland, or we could say that both those three votes negate each other and Rick Miller gets to choose with his Dark Shadows vote.
Oh man. Let's let the Electoral College decide. Yeah. So we've kind of been hopping through the decades. Oh man, this is tough. Because on one hand, I want to say like, well, Alice in Wonderland is at least going to be like visually inventive. You know, there's like CG has come a long way, and there's that. But then, part of me just wants to face the hurt of Wonka.
Yeah.
Because I know that just seems like dead cold, and I'm going to go Alice in Wonderland. I'm going Alice in Wonderland.
All right, Alice in Wonderland. Yeah.
And you've already seen this?
No, I've seen the Wonka remake. Alice in Wonderland, I saw a little bit of at a bar one time without the sound on. So I sort of know what it looks like a little bit.
Yeah, the headspace I'm in right now, I can't sanction that Johnny Depp, Michael Jackson thing that he's got going on.
Yeah,
there,
it's really awkward. The, Deep Roy playing all of the Oompa Loompas is really just, it's not cool. So yeah. All right. We're going to do, Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
I think this is probably our last Tim Burton, right?
Probably. I mean, we could always, finish it up with, didn't he do Big Eyes? The movie about the painter with Amy Adams.
Well, whatever. We'll tell them next time. All right.
We'll figure it out. Yeah. Right, yeah. So, we're going to get into some deep hurting.
Yeah. Some deep pain with, Alice in Wonderland.
Yep.
All right. Well, remember to go to Jaws Pod. Tell us what movies to watch next. And John Knox 8 stuff on Twitter.
Yep.
Yep. All right. Bye.
Bye.